Welcome to the Humans and AI Podcast, powered by AI Frontier Network. I'm your host, Flor La Orga. Each episode, we dive into the human story shaping artificial intelligence through the journeys of entrepreneurs, builders, and leaders. We explore the insights, challenges, and visions for the future of AI and humanity. Let's uncover the human side of AI together. Great. Hi, Georg. Thank you very much for joining to the Humans and AI podcast. I appreciate that you were able to make it because I know that we are all busy. So thank you very much for making time for this. Yeah, I'm very excited of this conversation. Let's start. So for what I've read about you, you have a long journey, a long career already. So you've worked in more corporate companies like Microsoft, Jammer, as well you work in Tesla. Right now, you are CEO of Phrase. So before going into all those details, I would love to, if you can take us back at the beginning and how did you start to be interested in the world of technology?
Thanks, Flora. I appreciate you having me on the podcast. It's great to be here. I've been with the company for 3.5 years and it's a wonderful company. I'm sure we'll spend some time talking about it. But I first got into technology when I was a kid. Like so many other people, I found it magical, this ability to make things happen and create new worlds and learn about the world. I'm 44, so I remember dial-up internet. In fact, I remember life before the internet. And this industry has always fascinated me because it's changing all the time. And I think I'm a very curious person. I'm forever tinkering. I'm always trying to do something in a new or a different way. So I think it suits me to be in the technology industry because we should be all about embracing change. And I'm very comfortable with change. And so I think it's been a good career choice.
What was that? Because you've been as well a part of now being the CEO of Phrase. You, as I said in the beginning, you were also working in big corporates. So what was the lessons that you've learned from these big corporates? For example, lessons on leadership, like how you now lead in your company. Did you learn and did that influence you in your leadership style?
Yeah, I think I've had a few very formative experiences that have informed, you know, how I think about leadership. So actually, it probably starts before I began work, because between university and really starting my career, although I did a bit of work, but I took part in a round the world yacht race. So I actually was one of a number of people on a boat that sailed around the world against the prevailing winds and tides. And through that experience, learned quite a bit about sort of leadership, good leadership, bad leadership. And also that leadership, and this is something I still say to my team today, that leadership is a behavior, not a job title. Leadership is how you show up in the middle of the night when people need you or under stress. It's not what it says on your business card, resume, LinkedIn profile, whatever. I've seen people with wonderful titles exhibit very poor leadership, and I've seen people with no title at all be extraordinary leaders that you would follow into any kind of situation. So that was the first very important lesson. And I think at Microsoft, I learned a lot about scale, also about mentoring. I had some very amazing mentors at Microsoft, also about remote working, actually, because my boss for the last couple of years there, who was an amazing mentor, she was based in Norway and I was in the UK, and actually our team was remote. I think there were 9 or 10 of us and all dotted around Europe. So I learned about remote culture building early on in my career, sort of 2007, 8, 9, around then. And then at Yammer, I learned actually from a colleague, a chap called Mike Graffam, who has gone on to have a fantastic career. And we're doing a little bit of work together now, actually, also at Phrase. So he helped me understand the power of leadership via context, so that leadership, which at Microsoft was still relatively hierarchical, certainly when I was there, it was a while ago. I don't know what it's like now, but it was still quite hierarchical. Mike really helped open my eyes to the power of enabling people by providing them with fantastic context and allowing for rich, open debate, and then thereby letting great people do their best work. And so that sort of leadership through context has been a really important part of my approach ever since. And then at Tesla, I guess the next big company, it was a different leadership style altogether, very high urgency, very unique actually to that culture. It was not a leadership style that translates very well anywhere else, but obviously worked quite well in that context. But yeah, I had a coach when I was at Smoothwall who had an amazing impact on me. She really taught me to broaden my different leadership styles. So I've been very fortunate to have a whole series of different influences.
Great, thanks for sharing. For what I understood, Phrase is a world leader in translation technology, but you guys are working on localization, right? So how do you personally connect with the idea of making technology accessible across languages and cultures?
I think this is where we're talking about change in technology being a constant thing. And of course, AI is a very exciting development and an accelerant of a lot of change. And it's opening up many new use cases for technology to have impact on language. I guess the easiest way to think about it is that for thousands of years, translation or localization, which is, if you think about a translation as being a literal translation from language A to B, localization is about trying to get the meaning right, which may be a slightly different thing. And historically, for thousands of years, this has been something that's happened in a linear process where contents get created, and then at some point, someone decides to translate it more or less at the end of some content production line. What we're doing with Phrase now is really embedding multilingual content at every stage of content production, from generation to propagation to making sure that products can launch in multiple languages from the beginning, that multilingual content is at the heart of business strategy to enable competitive advantage, to enable a company to move faster as it goes to market, but also to have a different and better and improved and much more personal relationship with 8 billion people on the planet. So now through technology, you can scale something that you could never have scaled through humans alone, which is, again, our industry must be one of the oldest industries on the planet, and it's been human powered for most of its history. Now, but that doesn't scale. Now with technology, we can scale multilingual content in a way that is orders of magnitude bigger, faster, more creative, more personalized than has ever been possible before.
Okay, so do you have any story of the people who use Phrase that was a kind of success story that you could share as an example as how technology connect with the humans side of?
Yeah, sure, plenty. I'll give you an interesting example, which I think touches on a lot of different themes. So we've been working for some time with a technology company that is a women's health network. And so it provides information on female health to women all around the world, at every age range and in every culture and in many languages. And when we first started working with them, one of the things they told us was that actually 60% of their revenue was already coming from non-English speaking markets. So their home market was English speaking and their content was all English. And 60% of revenue was coming from non-English speaking markets. So I think they were actually very forward thinking, because it's possible that they could have concluded, well, already doing very well. But what they looked at was a level deeper. The engagement with the content of people in those markets was much less. So what they started to see was the opportunity. If they could equal the engagement, the depth of the engagement of women with the content in non-English markets as they had in the English markets, then that 60% could actually be a much larger sort of real terms amount. So now the problem, of course, is how do you scale content that is as sensitive, both from a scientific perspective in terms of accuracy, but also from a cultural perspective in terms of the subject matter can be very personal. And we're talking about biology and these kinds of things. So how do you get that right at scale, affordably, without using humans, which of course would make it unaffordable? So we've been working with them for really quite some time to develop AI technologies that allow for that content to be adapted. So you talk to a 16-year-old woman in one culture in a completely different way about similar biology to a 60-year-old woman in a different culture. And doing that correctly, appropriately, accurately, sensitively with AI has been a fantastic project to be part of. And it pulls together a lot of different themes we've already touched on.
Well, sounds great. So you've led Phrase through a lot of growth. And so what's been the most important lesson you've learned while scaling the company?
Gosh, I think one very important lesson is that it isn't just one thing. It's not any one thing, right? So it's about doing 1,000 things right every day. And Actually, of course, the reality is you do, let's say you do 1,000 things right. Simultaneously, you're probably doing 200 things wrong as well. So the first thing is, how do you try and get more things right than wrong? And then how do you react to the things that are going wrong? And so I think maybe you could begin with culture, because actually trying to have influence as a leader, clearly you cannot be in every meeting, you cannot be on every call. So how do you set the tone and the culture for people to do the right thing? We start with our values, embracing diversity, operating as teams, being proactive, respecting one another, respecting customers. Those values run pretty deep. We talk about customers very respectfully as one of our values, which sounds obvious, but actually, I've seen that in many companies. It's not always the case behind the scenes. But I'm old enough to remember someone saying to me that smile when you're on the telephone, the other side can hear it. And I think there's something about how you talk when the customers are not in the room that actually changes how one is perceived by the customers when they are in the room. So I think that's very important. We have very high innovation cadence at Phrase, and it's not an accident. It's a very deliberate thing. We actually run a sort of operating system for the company that we call the Cadence, which is an operating system for product engineering and marketing on one quarterly cycle, and then sales and finance on another quarterly cycle. And we overlap those cycles. And the idea is that not everyone is having peaks at the same time. And actually, the two cycles interact in such a way that support the launching of new products into the market, the generation of pipeline, the closing of pipeline. And that's worked very well, so well that we've now done, I think, 14 consecutive quarters of on-time launch dates. So we've not missed a launch date, and we do a launch every 90 days, or at least 4 times a year. We've never missed a launch date in 14 quarters, which is extraordinary. And so as a result of that, we have a reputation in the market for a continuous flow of innovation. And I think that's been one of the reasons that we're successful. And as I said at the very beginning, there's hundreds of other things. But if I was going to summarize some of the pillars, I suppose those would be them.
Okay, thanks. Now we're going to get into more kind of the human side of the podcast. What does it mean to build a human-centered tech culture in a world that is mostly now shaped by AI, in your opinion?
What was the question? What does it mean to build a human-centered tech company?
Yes. Like
Yeah.
tech culture, not company culture.
Oh, culture. Sorry.
Yes.
I think curiosity and respect, they're embedded in our values, actually. I meet every new starter at Phrase, and I spend time with them in small groups. And I always take the first thing I do is I talk about our values and I explain how they came about. What every one of our values, they're on our website. There's a sentence and a paragraph underneath, and we're actually doing a piece of work now because it's good to refresh these things every 3 or 4 years. So we've had them for about 3.5 years. So now we're going to do a little refresh, and we're not going to fundamentally change them, but we might expand slightly to think about actually the impact of AI. And then we're actually going to provide just even more detail underneath. We really want people, Phrase, to be able to find some grip in the values, to be able to hold on to them and say, I recognize that behavior as being in line or not with our values, and we want them to be actionable things. But the two things are curiosity and respect, I think, fundamentally. So if you're curious about the world, right, life just gets better, and we spend more time at work than we do with our friends, family, children. And I'm not here to say if that's right or wrong. It's just true. And it should be fun. It should be challenging, but it should also be fun. And it's a lot more fun if you're curious and you're learning from other people. And I think actually, and it doesn't matter what role you're in, this is true for all roles, right? Life just gets better when you're curious and you're learning something new, and your brain is working and growing, and you have that mindset. So I think curiosity, that makes the business more human. And then respect. And that's, again, it's very much in our values, but like respect for oneself, respect for other people. There's an important element, actually, which is to assume good intentions. We're quite a remote organization. And I often joke that as anyone who's ever had a long distance relationship, like myself, knows, communications at a distance are just harder than in person. So if you can assume good intentions on the part of your counterparty and work from there and combine that with respect and curiosity, I think you go a long way. And ultimately, I had a great experience recently with a gentleman called Brian Klass, who I saw speak on a stage. And then I had the opportunity to introduce him onto that stage, and I spoke to him beforehand and afterwards, and I'd also then invited him recently to come and speak at our company. And he was asked a related question, and he said, one of the things, how do we know we're succeeding with AI? And it's when AI is actually helping us to be more human, not less. So when AI is helping us to communicate more effectively around the world, that's good. That's more human. When AI is like a replacement for a real human relationship, that's not good. So it's how do we, as a society around the world, how do we get that balance right? Of course, it's important to think about.
Okay, since you just mentioned about respecting curiosity, so I would like to apply this a little bit for the team, your team, for example. So you work across regions and different time zones, different as well with different cultures. What have you learned about trust?
It's you can't do business without it, because in the absence of trust, you have rules or fear in order to make things work, and that's a horrible way to live. So trust is pretty important. So trust, I think, is critical whether you're talking about customers, whether you're talking about staff, whether you're talking about your team. It's also something that you can lose in an instant, and it takes time to build it up. And it's different across different cultures, actually. And people have individual approaches. We did an exercise in our leadership team, actually, to try and understand, even amongst our leadership team, who by this time had worked together for some time, actually, how do we think about trust? Do you start by giving it and then let people chip away? Or some other people have an approach where they start by not giving it and they let people earn it. So people come at it very much from two different angles as well, glass half full, glass half empty, and then figure it out. I think cultures are different as well. A phrase we have a lot of folks in the Czech Republic. And what's fascinating there, and something I hadn't experienced before from a cultural perspective, is to work with people who still remember life under communism. That we have colleagues who were 14, 15 years old when communism ended in the Czech Republic. So they remember going to school with an instruction from their parents that said, "Be careful, you cannot talk at school about the things we talk about at home. For fear of dot 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 the secret police." And that for me, growing up in the UK, was not an experience, obviously, that I had ever had. And it's not one I'd ever thought that I would have professionally, to meet someone who had that background. And of course, it was very interesting because in a sort of transatlantic UK, US, Northern Europe, Western Europe type work culture, there's a lot of conversation about working in the open, being transparent, show you're working early. And actually, what this gentleman was trying to educate me on was that this is not necessarily the work culture that some other people were most comfortable with, or actually they would like to be able to work in private to build things up to the level at which they're ready to show other people what it is. And that was very different from my working cultures. The first is, of course, to understand where each other are coming from and then try and find the common ground, and then slowly to show that both approaches have some merit and both can trust one another, but also both can get a little closer to each other with time in both directions. That's important.
Okay, in your view, what role should community play in shaping the journey of AI and technology?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that
Yeah,
question?
so in your perspective, what role should community
Oh,
play,
community.
play a role,
Well,
yeah.
yeah, community. Gosh, it's a big question, isn't it? There's lots of different angles to take into that. I think going back to AI is at its best when it helps us be more human. I think it's important for us just to keep that in mind, or at least the best qualities of humans. Because, of course, one of the things that is often discussed with AI is that it can reflect the bias of the creator. So when I say reflect the best qualities of the human, we also need to. So the community can probably play quite a good role in sort of sense checking the outputs. And we've seen that already. And Google famously, Grok famously, have had some really horrific kind of faux pas with their AIs either being historically inaccurate on the left-leaning side of politics or horribly offensive on the right side of politics. These machines just say things that the community disagrees with, and the community can identify that. The community can provide a rapid feedback loop for improvement. So I think that's one way that sort of human reinforcement learning at the community level can be quite an important development for AI. I think we also have to decide as communities, and the answers may be different in different parts of the world, what we want out of AI. Where do we feel AI plays a role and where it doesn't? There will be moments where AI is more trusted and moments where it's less. And I guess the communities will decide that. I think, I actually had the privilege to go to OpenAI's headquarters in early, when was it? Must have been March 2024. No, March 2023. I can't remember exactly, but fairly early on. Sam Altman was there and I asked him about deepfakes. And his answer was curious to me. He said, and I don't agree with it, he said, S says deep, he said basically, fakes have always existed. Society has learned to cope and it will just have to figure it out. And that seems to me to be not the right answer when the technology is now so capable of producing deep fakes that are so convincing. And the two things have to go together. They can be propagated so fast and so far that a lot of misinformation and harm can be done before society, which moves more slowly than AI, has the time to figure it out. So I think actually the community cannot be expected to simply self-police on this, and technology actually has to play a role in policing itself.
Okay, that was very interesting. Well, yeah, the thought about Sam Altman is funny. Okay, so let's move on. So Phrase runs academy program that supports the next generation of localization professionals. Why do you decide to do it? Like, I know that we, right now I'm bringing it up because we're talking a bit of community and culture and team. So I think that was interesting question to, I was curious about it.
Personally, I've always been a believer that there's no greater force for kind of economic good in the world than capitalism done right. And so, what I mean by capitalism done right is this kind of multi-stakeholder capitalism that believes that a rising tide floats all boats. I think that a healthy ecosystem of competitors is a good thing in any market. And I think that a company should invest in the future of the market and therefore should support academic programs, should support also not-for-profit. And we try to do that. We are clearly a commercial organization, and I'm not at all embarrassed by that. I think commercial organizations are the main drivers of innovation in the world. But I think with that also comes an opportunity to, I guess, help the tide rise. And so, yeah, we do academic programs. We provide Phrase Academy, which itself is a series of materials to help localization experts learn how to use our platform and become more proficient.
That's also interesting. So, how do you apply ethical AI in your culture?
It's interesting. I think AI gets a particular focus on this, and it should, because of course the scale at which it can propagate things, as we talked about. But in another sense, it's not like we do more ethics or less ethics depending on the subject. We just do ethics. And so when we think about employing AI inside our company, we for our own productivity and our internal tooling, and then when we use AI in the product itself, we try and apply the same standards of data privacy, data controls, respect for the individual as we would do in any technology decisions. So we're very transparent on what we do with customer data. If you go on our website, down at the bottom, there's a little link for an AI section that gives detailed information on what we do with customer data, with permission, with explicit permission, and so on. So anyone who's curious on understanding that can go there and get the facts for themselves. And that transparency, I think, is very important. And I think just as importantly, we actually do what we say we do, because that's not always the case. There are companies that say one thing, do another. We actually do what we say we do, which I think matters. And yeah, we just try and make sure that fairness and equity and the principles of good moral standards are implemented everywhere.
And how does your team embrace AI in their roles? Because there's a lot of people afraid of losing their jobs because of AI, for example. So I've heard because of other interviews that there they don't say, but I kind of see that there are people that they some of the teams they are not wanna embrace as much as they could, or some they just don't care. They just this is we just want to do it with humans because it's what it matters, which is completely, I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'm just asking, like, in what is in your situation, for example, in your context.
Yeah. So just very, very specifically to our context, I'll talk about that. We are enormous adopters of AI across the whole business and in every role. And we've actually been very explicit. That's our expectation for people as well. all the way back to that trip to OpenAI's headquarters, I very much came back with high conviction. We paid for everybody in the company to have ChatGPT licenses and training. And the training is just as important because you want to get value out of it. And my sense was these technologies are going to improve. We're at the bottom of an S curve. When you make compounding good decisions, you get those benefits slowly at the beginning, but then rapidly in the future. And so I'd rather start early. There's a saying, I'm not sure who to attribute it to, which I love though, which is, when is the best time to plant a tree? And the answer is 20 years ago. The second best time is today. So my sense was, I didn't want to wake up in 2 years' time and say, oh, I wish we'd been investing in the AI skills of our company 2 years ago. So we started like really early on and across every department. And obviously ChatGPT is universally used. GitHub Copilot is used in engineering. There's a lot of other tools now, from Lovable to all the tools in marketing and in sales and in CS. Everything is AI enabled. And I think importantly, everybody, including myself, writes GPTs. We write custom GPTs. We interact with them. We use them as thought partners. We've learned as well, I think, how to use them well and what to use them for and when to spot now that there's the confirmation bias that you get a lot with ChatGPT, or how do you question what you're getting? How do you make sure to improve the quality of the output so that they have a really good impact on your thinking? The job thing is interesting. We had a small amount of that in one department, but I think fairly quickly when people started to actually use it, what they realized was that this was about enabling them to be much, much more productive and therefore to do more of the things that they would have loved to do, but perhaps never had the time. And the final thought is, I said really early on, because there was at the time, there were people in the market saying with these technologies, engineers are going to get so much more efficient that we'll need fewer of them. So what I said really early on to everyone in the company is, we are not going to have fewer people. What I would rather is that everybody was 10 times as productive. So there's the challenge. The challenge isn't, you know, we're only going to keep 6 out of 10 people and everyone has to fight for their jobs. The challenge is we're going to keep the same 10 people, but I expect everybody to get 10 times more productive over time, not like overnight, but over time. So when you set the bar really high for that productivity, of course, there's a sort of performance pressure and adoption pressure around AI. And we make no bones about that. But what we said is, we're in an innovation arms race in the technology space, and I would rather have 10 people be 10 times more productive, the equivalent of 100 people, than have the organization go from 10 people to 6, each of whom is more productive, because the first approach will win an innovation arms race. And that's how I think about it.
Okay, that's cool. Before we talk, just in the beginning, actually, we talk a little bit about mentors. So do you have, I know that you've got a lot of mentors, but do you have one special, like a person who really changed, like really, a bit more than the rest, really help you to start your journey and really, become who you are? Well, you are, it's for many things, but yeah.
I think, there's different ways to answer that. I think probably the best sort of comment to make, which is maybe actionable for other people as well, is that when I was CEO of my previous company, I had come out of Tesla, which was a very intense environment, and into my first CEO job. And I carried over this incredible intensity into this new environment. And I had one mode, 100 miles an hour, 100% of the time, 7 days a week. And it was appropriate. It was necessary at Tesla. It was challenging for other people to deal with in this new environment. And so my head of HR tapped me on the shoulder and she said, have you ever considered coaching? And I said, yeah, I have. I'm really open to it. I got close once, but then circumstances changed. And yeah, I don't know, but I'm not sure if... So I was open. I had just not prioritized it. So she said, I think it might be a good idea. So we found a coach, and I talked to a whole bunch of different coaches, and finding the right one is really important. I found this amazing coach called Becky Falkingham, and she's still out there. She's still a coach, and she was phenomenal for me. And she helped me discover different ways of being a better CEO by throttling down as well as up, as she put it, different golf clubs in the golf bag. I'm not a golfer, but I know what she meant. Use the appropriate tool at the appropriate time with the appropriate person, etc. Yeah, I think the most actionable thing I could say is that people listening to this should really make the time, make that prioritized time to find a formal coach that they can talk to who's independent of friends, family, colleagues, boss, and who is trained in coaching, and make that investment in yourself.
Thank you for sharing. I think it's always good that asking for help, or that, because I think that everything, like we cannot do everything by ourselves.
for sure not.
Okay, so we are almost at the end. Georg, looking forward, what kind of legacy do you hope to leave?
I'm 44, so I haven't thought too much about legacy yet. Hopefully I've got a little distance to run. But I always thought there's lots of ways to run a company. I worked at Tesla. I saw Elon up close. And I think there's a lot that's extraordinary about Elon. And some of it's extraordinarily good and some of it's extraordinarily bad. And the important thing is to choose what's important to you. So you can run a company successfully with fear. It's not a bad way to run a company, if depending on what you care about, right? But I didn't want to live life like that. I wanted to run a company in a different way and still be successful. And so what legacy do I want to leave? I would like, hard not to sound grandiose when you talk about legacy. I would just like people to enjoy their work, do it to the best of their ability, and think that it was fun and that I was as helpful as I could be.
Okay, thank you. And yeah, this is kind of a last question. Would you like to give any advice or share anything that we haven't touched on in the interview before we wrap up?
I think don't be afraid. I'm often accused of being an optimist, and I am an optimist. I think history is full of horrors, but nevertheless, humanity has generally been a story of progress. And I think the optimist is someone who will experiment. And I think experimentation is very important, and actually particularly now because the world is changing so fast. And so it becomes increasingly difficult in any sphere or walk of life to be able to predict exactly what is coming around the corner. And therefore, having plans is important, but being able also to pivot, very important. So experimentation, an open mind, a positive attitude, dust yourself off, go again, and keep smiling.
Oh, that was beautiful. Thank you, Georg. So I've got an amazing time here with you chatting, and I've learned a lot about your different perspectives as well, all your journey the companies that you've been, which, I mean, you're only 44, but you kind of work in many things. So I was kind of, wow, that's a very rich, actually, journey, I have to say, a career. And yeah, thank you very much, Georg.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks for listening to the Humans and AI podcast. We are here to spotlight the people making AI more human, one story at a time. See you in the next episode.